Good morning. I call this meeting of the Commerce, Policy, and Finance Committee to order for Wednesday, March 25th. A quorum is present. First order of business on the day is adoption of the minutes. May I get a motion for the minutes, please?
So move, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Davids moves the minutes for from Tuesday, March 24th, from 2026. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion or opposed, motion prevails. Yep. All right. So we're going to juggle our schedule a little bit. And first on the agenda will be Representative Bierman. So... welcome to the committee, Representative Bierman. House File 4347 is before us, and I will move the bill to Ways and Means. So, Representative Bierman, welcome to the committee, and please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair Cagle. Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll, for hearing this important bill today. Members, this is a straightforward clarification bill that closes an apparent loophole in an existing health care mandate on home care nursing services that has been law since 2010. It is not a new mandate and does not add costs to the commercial plans or to the state budget. When the legislature passed the 2010 law, the intent was very clear. For people on medical assistance who also have a commercial plan, the commercial plan is responsible for covering home care nursing services. Home care nursing is continuous, medically necessary care that keeps medically complex people with high needs out of the hospital and safely in their homes. The purpose of the mandate was to stop cost shifting onto the state and to keep this vulnerable population out of the hospital. For 15 years, commercial plans followed this mandate without issue. That changed this year. Two plans have reinterpreted the statute and capped home care nursing coverage to just 10 days per year for 2026. 10 days for a service that is medically necessary on an ongoing basis. This is a dramatic departure from long-standing practice and from the legislature's original intent. In recent discussions, the plans have said that the 2010 law doesn't say that they cannot cap coverage and that they actually have just been covering these services out of their own goodwill for 15 years, not because they thought they were required to. The plans have said they applied these caps because they want these families to move to medical assistance. That is the problem here, and the exact opposite of the 2010 mandate's cost-sharing intent. Shifting this care onto Medicaid means families lose their waiver budgets and access to therapies that traditional Medicaid does not cover. Providers take a rate cut. The home care nursing workforce shortage worsens. Families lose their nurse staffing consistency, and the state Medicaid budget absorbs the full cost of care. Members, this is important for you to understand. If we do not pass this clarification and close this loophole this year, this reinterpretation will shift millions of dollars onto the state budget. Not just the home care nursing costs, but the total cost of care, hospitalizations, medications, enteral nutrition, all of it. Many families choose commercial insurance specifically for the reliable nursing hours. With only 10 days of coverage, there is no incentive to keep commercial insurance at all, and the state will be on the hook, and the plans off the hook for the total cost of care. For the 200 to 250 people in this category, annual care costs range from $300,000 to $1 million. If the commercial plans no longer wanted to cover this care, they should have come to the legislature with a bill to change it. The health plans are not lawmakers and cannot unilaterally decide who pays for this care when there is existing law already dictating that. Their decision caused harm and wasted countless hours of families' time as they were left to figure this change out on their own. In the 2010 House Health Committee hearing where this provision was discussed, Representative Huntley said, "These people who are eligible for medical assistance but have health insurance through their family, the health insurance would have to cover the cost of nursing, and the state would not pay medical assistance for that service." Members, the intent was crystal clear. The 2010 mandate was a deliberate choice by lawmakers. The commercial plans, not medical assistance, would cover medically necessary home care nursing, care needed on day one and on days 11 through 365. This is not a complicated bill. It is a simple clarification of the legislative intent and maintains the last 15 years of practice. I ask for the committee's support, and we have testifiers here today who can speak to the negative impacts of such a drastic coverage cap. If we could go to testifiers, please, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. And so first up, we have Brandon Walters, followed by Catherine Chambers. Nice to see you again. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brandon Walter, and I am here from Medina, Minnesota. I'm here today to support HF 4347 for my medically complex son, my family, and so many other medically complex families in the state of Minnesota. I had my full testimony prepared for today, but last night I received a call from a mother of a medically complex child who was in absolute panic. Her home care nursing agency had just informed her yesterday that her 120 visit cap imposed by Health Partners had not only been reached but been exceeded. And they were calling to ask how she planned to pay for the services keeping her daughter alive. I'd like to rewind for a moment. This family received an approval letter from Health Partners in December of 2025, stating that their daughter was covered for the entire 2026 calendar year for home care nursing. Then, on January 19th, just 4 days after open enrollment ended, they received a second letter saying Health Partners would now cover only 120 visits for the entire year, a tiny fraction of what their daughter is prescribed. These health plan companies have told us, and they'll probably tell you today, that they've notified all county case managers. Well, I can tell you, I have spoken personally to many of those county case managers throughout different counties, and none of them have heard from Medica or Health Partners regarding this issue. This is the real consequences of an arbitrary limit imposed by a commercial insurer that has known for 15 years exactly what Minnesota State Statute 62Q.545 requires. This statute acts as a load-bearing Jenga block. If you pull it out, the entire medically complex community collapses. Families financially devastated, parents forced out of the workforce, children pushed into hospitals because they cannot safely remain at home any longer. This is not theoretical. It is happening right now and will continue to happen to these families one by one. This needs to be stopped immediately. Please pass HF 4347. Keep these kids at home. Keep them out of hospitals and stop insurers from dismantling a mandate that has protected medically complex children for more than a decade. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Kit Chambers, and I live in Plymouth, Minnesota. I'm here today with my son Nash and his nurse Maddie in support of HF 4347. This bill matters to my family because Nash has both private insurance and medical assistance. We use the Community Alternative Care Waiver, CAC waiver, through the Consumer Directed Community Supports, CDCS. This option helps Nash live and thrive in our community rather than the hospital, where he spent the first 476 days of his life. During that 15-month hospital stay, I dreamed of what life would be like outside the fourth floor NICU. I knew that given the chance, Nash would thrive at home, and I did not expect that fighting for this dream would bring me here today, talking to all of you. I chose this path of private insurance and medical assistance so Nash could get the care he needs in our community, so we could pay our nurses a competitive wage without exhausting our waiver budget. Right now, the way nursing is paid creates serious problems for families like ours. Private insurance pays first, then medical assistance, and then the waiver can only cover authorized services. If any part of that care is denied, capped, or not fully covered, the cost can fall back on my family directly or onto the waiver budget, which is not designed to absorb nursing hours. If nursing hours are shifted onto the waiver, Nash loses services that are vital to his quality of life, like music therapy, massage therapy, pool therapy, and our much-needed respite care. And beyond that, the hours I'm paid to cover the gaps in his 24-hour, 365-days-a-year care when nursing agencies are unavailable. The supports that hold up this system, private insurance, medical assistance, and the waiver, are becoming increasingly fragile, and that creates instability for essential, ongoing nursing care. For Nash, nursing is not optional. It allows him to go to school, receive therapies, attend medical appointments, and remain safely at home. I'm also paid through Nash's waiver for some of his care, which means I know firsthand that caregiving is not a path to wealth. It is hard work, and it comes with a sacrifice. Families like ours live in constant awareness that anything can change in a moment, especially as we've watched our children fight to breathe and to exist in this world. We're familiar with fear, often oscillating between gratitude and grief. Is there any data that shows nursing limit caps, improve patient care, or reduce harm for medically fragile children or their families? I urge you to support HF 4347 to stop this coverage cap before it causes lasting harm to families like mine. Thank you for your time and the work you do on behalf of all Minnesota families.
Thank you. Next up is Cameo Zander, followed by Chelsea Olson. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Cameo Zender, and I'm with Pediatric Home Service. I wanted to briefly provide some perspective through the provider lens. Home care nursing for medically complex children is hospital-level care delivered in the home environment. In order to safely care for these children, agencies like ours must recruit and retain highly skilled nurses trained to manage ventilators, complex medications, and very quickly changing conditions of these children. To do that, we rely on the commercial insurance rates, which are higher than the Medicaid rate and mutually agreed upon between the health plan and the provider. These rates allow us to pay that competitive wage similar to what a nurse can earn in the hospital environment. If this is allowed to continue, we will have no choice but to reduce nurse wages to Medicaid levels. And when that happens, nurses leave home care. We are already in a critical workforce shortage. A study conducted in the state of Minnesota showed that medically complex children remained in the hospital on average 54 days past the date they were medically ready to go home, solely because of lack of access to home care nursing. We understand that healthcare is complicated. We understand that if this continues, access will shrink. Families will lose care, children will remain in the hospital or be pushed into institutional settings, and hundreds of millions of dollars will transfer to the state. Like I said, healthcare is complicated. This bill is not. We urgently ask for your support of House File 4347 to clarify and confirm the legislative intent as it was established in 2010. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Up next is Chelsea Olson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Chelsea Olson with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 4347, and thanks to those who shared their stories today. We want to let you know that we hear you and that our member plans are committed to finding a solution that ensures families get the care that they need. As we talked about in this committee earlier in session, there are already significant cost challenges in the individual market due to rising health care costs. These high costs have resulted in significant losses for carriers, fewer plan options in some counties, the insolvency of UCare, and premium increases. The current products in the market were reviewed and approved by Commerce and include limitations on home health care services. Chair Bierman mentioned the high cost of these home health care services. With the bill as written, we are concerned that removing all limitations on commercial coverage will make it difficult to keep premiums from rising even further and maintain access to care. We are meeting with stakeholders, and we will be constructive in working to find a solution to maintain access to these important services.
Thank you. Thank you. Next up, we have Kelly Wolf, followed by Barbara Cox. And Ms. Cameron, if you want to go back to the audience, if there's any questions, we can call you back up. Oh, go ahead.
No. I'm sorry, were you talking to me?
No, I'm Ms. Zender, if you want to go back to the audience, and then if there's any questions, we can call you back up.
Very good.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Wolf. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Great, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Wolf, and I'm the Senior Director of Government Relations at Medica. We are a nonprofit health plan that currently serves more than 1.4 million people in Minnesota and across the Midwest. Thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts today regarding House File 4347. First, let me say we do fully recognize the importance that home nursing services are for children with complex medical conditions. And we do share the goal of ensuring that those children continue to receive the care that they need. In the fall of 2024, we made a decision to reevaluate the administration of extended home health benefits for individuals who were also enrolled in the medical assistance program beginning in 2026. We did that with the understanding that Medicaid would continue to provide the nursing services that these children qualify for. Medicaid provides the most comprehensive benefit set of any type of insurance, including the lowest cost to the patient due to limited cost sharing. In fact, nearly 70% of home care nationally, including private duty home nursing, is paid for by Medicaid, which has historically been the provider of comprehensive medical services, particularly for children with disabilities and chronic conditions. Medicaid also provides a level of consistency that private insurance plans sometimes cannot, or employer-sponsored insurance that could change due to employment transitions or other life events. As the safety net program providing coverage to children with disabilities, Medicaid is often most suitable in those circumstances. Our state has created a system to help support these families with a combination of comprehensive Medicaid services and various waiver programs. The Medicaid waivers are designed to cover extended services such as private duty home nursing care. If there is an issue with families accessing their waivers, insufficient waiver funds, or the definition of authorized services and what can be covered, then we are open to exploring those solutions. We do share the goal of ensuring that these children and families continue to receive the care that they need, and we are open to conversations to explore some of those alternatives. We do have a scheduled meeting in the next couple of weeks with the advocates and with DHS to talk through some of those solutions. Again, we remain hopeful that we can come to an agreement that allows these families continuity of coverage and care.
Thank you. Ms. Cox, state your name for the record and proceed. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Barbara Cox. I'm here testifying on behalf of Health Partners. We also hear the committee's deep concern for families with needs for intensive home health services for their children with complex health needs. We want to work with policymakers, DHS, and counties, and are also engaged in the upcoming meeting to do so. so that families can have a smooth transition to services and medical assistance when they reach their coverage limits in commercial plans. In the case of Health Partners, the limits we have in our coverage we have had in our policies since 2014. We also support increased benefit levels for these members of medical assistance to further support these families should the legislature choose to increase those benefits, as well as provider pay, in order to address some of the concerns related to the waiver. The legislature could raise the reimbursement rate for providers for this subset of enrollees to commercial levels in Medicaid. Thank you for the opportunity to share our perspective.
While I have you both up there, I have a few questions, please. So from my understanding, Medicaid actually put a, or Medica actually told patients prior that they were not going to cover these services, correct?
So we made the decision in November of 2024 after an annual review of our benefits and compliance with state laws and regulations. We consulted with our regulators to ensure that our interpretation was correct. And in May of 2025, we sent our first letter to county case managers as well as to families that the plans would be changing as of January 2026. So we did provide advance notice, offer case management services, worked with families to address their questions and make sure that they could have the information that they needed for the upcoming year. And then we again provided notice to families in August. Just to, again, make sure that, that they were receiving the information that they needed and to help them through that transition.
Thank you. Ms. Cox, when did you guys make your clients aware of that this coverage was no longer going to be available?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the case of Health Partners, we let members know earlier this year that we would no longer be granting exceptions to the coverage limits. So while the coverage that members signed up for did not change, the coverage has been the same. In the past, we had a practice of granting exceptions to those limits, and we notified members that we were no longer able to do so earlier this year.
Was that before or after open enrollment closed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was after open enrollment closed.
So people signed up for plans thinking they were getting services, and then after open enrollment closed, you told them they no longer could get those services. Did you refund them their money for their premiums?
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. I am not aware of all of the details of our members' cases, and there's some data privacy rules that relate to those, but in the case, generally speaking, because members are getting the visits in their coverage and the exception was beyond the coverage limits that were in the policies, I don't believe so.
Thank you. So, Ms. Wolf, do you think when you notified your clients that they would not have coverage, that they probably sought coverage elsewhere?
Madam Chair, since we provided notice to families in May, I think that we thought two things would happen. One, that during that open enrollment period that they would continue to look for other plans that covered those benefits or provided a benefit plan that best suited their needs, or they would utilize Medicaid since these nursing services are covered through the Medicaid program in addition to waivers. So it was never our intent that families would not have coverage. We made the decision that we did knowing that we have a system in place through Medicaid and through the use of waivers that these families could access, and we tried to help them through that transition working with their county case managers. So we felt the time, which is why we gave them some advance notice to make those plans several months in advance.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for these testifiers? Representative Driscoll.
Just very quickly, Madam Chair, I want to clarify with both of the representatives from Health Partners and from Medica. Ms. Wolf, I want to just make sure you had indicated that in consultation with your regulator that you had made this decision. Who's the regulator that you consulted with?
Ms.
Wolf?
Madam Chair, Representative. We spoke with both DHS and the Department of Commerce when making this determination.
Madam Chair. Ms. Cox, same question to you.
I am not aware of working with regulators related to our practice. Regulators, you know, go through the process of approving our products. So because this was a change not in policy, coverage policy, just in the practice of granting these exceptions, I'm not aware if we sought approval from regulators.
One other follow-up question for Ms. Wolf. When you consulted with the regulators, did they give you any indication that these policies had been rated in such a way that it did include this benefit, and or did they agree with your interpretation that you maybe have gone beyond what the policy limits have had, and that in fact the department didn't approve these with that type of coverage in there?
Was that to Ms. Cox or to Ms. Oh, Ms. Wolf. Sorry.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. Yes, now, to be clear, I wasn't in those conversations, so I can't speak to the details, but I do know that we were providing a benefit that we felt far exceeded what the state law required, brought that inquiry to those regulators, and they agreed with our assessment, which is why we decided to move forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we do have Commerce here as well, so up next is Sam Smith from the Commerce Department. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Chairs Cagle and O'Driscoll, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm here to testify on House File 4347 on behalf of the Department of Commerce. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the challenges that many Minnesota families are experiencing regarding changes in how private insurance is administering home care nursing services. While medical assistance is available for these families to wrap around or supplement a major medical plan, this change can force tough choices with limited medical assistance budgets. The Department of Commerce is aware of these challenges, and our enforcement team has been responding to complaints in this space. While we are unable to comment on open investigations, I can share that some have concluded and others are ongoing. The Department of Commerce is neutral on this proposed bill and only notes that this is a complicated issue with no easy answers. We appreciate the work being done in this committee to respond to meaningful constituent concerns and to think through the interactions between private insurance and medical assistance. Thank you for your time, and we're happy to answer any member questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. That is it for the testifiers on the list. Is there anybody from the public wishing to testify? Going once, going twice. Testifying is closed. All right, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman, as I am also a co-author on this bill. First of all, I must say that I have a past in this in my previous life of dealing with these type of patients, from bringing them home for the first time to bringing them, unfortunately, back to the hospital. The heroes in this really are the parents. When you go into these homes or bring the kids home, the parents know the care. They know if it's not a specialty ambulance, we need the parents to go into the hospital because they know the equipment, they know the patient, and they know what's best. But one of the things, and this really took place back in the early 90s when I was still on the ambulance, and we figured that it was best to have the patient return home to their own community. So we were taking these patients from Moore Road down to Wells, across the whole state. And that's what's actually kind of neat, is that we knew that the outcome for the family and the outcome for the patient was better in their home communities. And where I'm having some issues with this today is that, and I get it, the payers have to make sure that they have their margins, but this is where we as the state partner with the payers and look at some of the things we do together to make sure that, a patient that lives in Wells can go home, can have the same care level as somebody that lives in Apple Valley, but yet also have the ability to come back if they need to. And I think this is where we really do have to lean on the payers here a little bit to make sure that this happens. We give them breaks in other areas. Sometimes they don't feel that, but I think that this is really an important subject, because we know that when you bring somebody to their home and their family is able to be united, that the patient and the family do much better. So I first, like I said, I want to call out the parents. They are like I just can't believe it. They are so great. They've taken this, it wasn't probably their choice, but they've taken this on, and they're just wonderful people. They're the neatest people in the world to meet, but also the providers, they're there. We saw one in the room today here, and this is really a special form, and I'm glad we can keep providing this, and I'm hoping we can come to an agreement or if we can get this bill through today. Thank you, Chair, for letting me make the statement here.
Thank you. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman, for your bill. I just want to get a clear understanding, and perhaps one of the testifiers can answer this. I'm not sure whom, but, you know, this seems like a question of continuity of care, right? We have care that is currently being provided to families who need care, and we appear to be at risk of having that care interrupted. Is that correct?
Representative Bierman.
Yes, Representative Finke, that is exactly correct.
Thank
you very much, Chair. Excuse me.
Sorry, and I may add, interruption is probably not an adequate word.
Yeah.
It's crumbling.
So I guess my question is to perhaps Commerce or one of the insurance lobbyists, what happens to the care? Like, if we don't pass this, what happens to these families? Just explicitly, like, do they lose their coverage?
Maybe one of the families. Ms. Chambers?
Hello again. Specific to us, because my only way of getting paid is through Nash's waiver, it all goes away. If it's capped at 120 visits, best case scenario, medical assistance matches. But they could approve zero. And there's a chance that 120 or 240 days into the year, care goes completely away. And that leaves us in September, where instead of going to school 3 days a week, my son will have me. And I won't be getting paid because it will be all gone. Thank you.
Representative Finke.
Thank you very much, Chair. I appreciate the time, and I appreciate you coming and bringing your family and sharing this experience. I don't know what we're doing if we take health care away from people who need health care. Like, what's the point of being a legislature if we aren't going to help people have access to care they currently have? And with respect to the testifier, health care coverage, saying that coverage is the same as when you enrolled, except for now there are new exceptions, is not the same coverage. It's different healthcare coverage. So we shouldn't assume that nothing has changed when something is clearly changing. And it's families who need care that are going to be at risk. So the point of all of the work that we do is to help people, and this seems to me like a way to help people. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Finke.
Thank you.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If Mr. Smith could return to the testifying table, please.
Welcome. Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Smith, I just want to pursue the line of questioning I had with the two representatives from Medica and Health Partners. Does the department, when they review policy forms every year and approve rates and like, what was the department's interpretation of this provision? Was it as it had been customarily done, or is it something that is the insurance companies had been doing but now are choosing not to do it from the policy form? Just trying to get clarification why for 15 or 16 years this hasn't been an issue and now it is, and what's the enforcement division of the department looking at doing with this?
Mr. Smith?
Chair Cagle, Chair O'Driscoll, thank you for the question. Well, the department can't speak to coverage choices made by the plans. What I can say is that when we are making enforcement decisions, it would depend on the particular facts and circumstances of any particular change to coverage limits. However, the department does not see anything in 62Q545 that prevents a health plan from placing limitations on its coverage of home care nursing services in its insurance contract.
Chair O'Driscoll?
Yeah, very quickly, Mr. Smith, so then the department didn't explicitly approve these forms with this coverage in there, is that correct?
Mr. Smith?
Chair Cagle, Chair O'Driscoll, out of an abundance of caution, I'll say that I'm not exactly sure on that, and so I have to get back to you.
Chair O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So this issue is actually really personal to me. 5 years ago on April 6th, my niece Isabel passed away. She was 18. She had a very, you know, it was hard. The emotional toll that these families are going through in limbo right now, I can't tell you how many families I've talked to, and it all ends in tears. I feel like this was super deceptive, handcuffing people into these plans to only tell them 4 days after open enrollment ended that they weren't going to have access to these services. The people who take care of these children, it's their life. It consumes them 24 hours a day, cleaning tubes, getting feedings ready, you know, making sure that they're in the standing chairs so that they can get the exercise they need, physical therapy. You know, it's a constant schedule of bringing these kids back and forth to appointments, to therapies, and then the parents are often exhausted and at the end of their ropes. I've seen it personally. I've seen the toll this takes on families. And putting more pressure on these families when all they're trying to do is take care of their kids is absolutely ridiculous. And if Commerce isn't interpreted, or if Commerce can't do anything about this, we can. That's our job. And if we really care about families and kids, and, you know, we need to do this. It was deceptive. It was wrong. And the family should not be suffering because of it. Representative Bierman, Chair Bierman, to your bill.
Are we final comments?
Yes, please.
Okay. Final comments. First off, I want to thank the families who have come this morning and told us their stories and the hardships that are out there for them. I want members to consider that Minnesota created a system in 2010 specifically for the insurers to be the first payer for home care nursing. And it is a system that the insurance companies have decided to change. The system was created in 2010. Some policy was changed at one of the providers in 2014. They granted exceptions, which to me means they followed the law. So I think it's very important that this committee move this bill forward, pass this bill, and to talk about a summit to come up with better ideas to handle this situation can still go forward as well. But in the meantime, let's let the law from 2010 stand until we decide to make a change to it. And I have no doubt that we can make a better system. But this is one small part of a healthcare system that we have massive work to do across the spectrum of our healthcare. And this is a small part, but a very important part. And it is not acceptable for the legislature not to act now and to kick this can down the road and create the hardships you're hearing. That will throw millions of dollars onto the state immediately, and that is not the intent of our current law. So we need to change that together, and I am more than happy to meet with plans, providers, and families to figure out better ways to do this. But first, we need to stable and right the ship. So thank you very much. I appreciate the committee's attention, and ask for your vote to support this bill to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Katisa-Mattoon.
I'd like to request a roll call.
Roll call being requested. All right. So I move that House File 4347 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Co-Chair Cagle.
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Co-Chair O'Driscoll?
No.
O'Driscoll, nay. Co-Vice Chair Elkins?
Aye.
Elkins, aye. Co-Vice Chair Perryman?
No.
Perryman, nay. Representative Allen?
No.
Allen, nay. Representative Buck excused. Representative Cha?
Aye.
Cha, aye. Representative Davids?
No.
Davids, nay. Representative Dotseth?
Nay.
Dotseth, nay. Representative Falconer?
Aye.
Falconer, aye. Representative Finke?
Aye.
Finke, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Heintzman?
No.
Heintzman, nay. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Representative Katizawatoon?
Aye.
Katizawatoon, aye. Representative Kreisha?
No.
Kreisha, nay. Representative Reimer?
No.
Reimer, nay. Representative Smith?
Aye.
Smith, aye. Representative Van Binsbergen?
No.
Van Binsbergen, nay. Representative West?
No.
West, nay. Madam Chair, there are 9 ayes and 10 nays.
Being 9 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. I'm sorry. Next on the agenda is Representative Greenman. Representative Greenman, we are bringing back House File 3739. I will move your bill before us, and I will.
Madam Chair, amend. I believe it's 3794.
Oh, sorry, did I read it wrong? 3794. Did I say 49? Anyway, so I will move 3794 before the committee with the intent to send it to the GR. I understand you have an amendment to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an amendment. Would you like me to explain the amendment?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment does 2 things. It strips out the wage discrimination piece, which we discussed in labor, and then it also includes an additional exception that was based on stakeholder feedback and the conversations that we had in this committee a couple weeks ago. There's also a fiscal note now on the record.
There is a fiscal note?
There is a fiscal note that says zero cost.
Zero cost, correct. All right, so I move the A6 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. All right, we have already taken public testimony on this bill. Representative Greenman, do you want to just give us a recap of what this bill does?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a simple bill. We already had a full discussion about it. This is about personalized surveillance pricing. When companies collect our data, when they spy on us and use that data to charge us more. All this bill does is prevent consumers from being ripped off by that practice of using data that they collect to personalize and to individualize a price. And that's what this bill does. It is a simple bill, and I think as we discussed last a couple of weeks ago, this is protecting the fair price, a price tag, and fair markets. Everybody should know what something costs, and they should be able to know that they're not being spied on in order to charge them more.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Is there any discussion to the bill? Representative Katizawatoon?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenman, for your work on this issue. I think how important this is, and how, you know, we recognize that the technological devices that we carry around in our pockets are always listening, and how it's difficult to have what you think is a private conversation without, you know, with a friend mentioning like some product or medicine that they've been using, and then all of a sudden you're getting these ads about it. And I just think that is something that I think we've all experienced, and all of a sudden that's all that you see after that conversation happens, even if you've never personally searched out something yourself. So I think that, you know, this is a really good baseline to make sure that consumers' data is protected, and we can do much more as technology continues to advance, but the legislature shouldn't just sit back and let technology take over. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
First of all, Chair, can I ask for a roll call?
Roll call being requested. We will have a roll call.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. This is a great bill. I think it's also worth saying that it is
a bill we should pass this year. We are seeing prices increase, and we know when there is a large volatility in prices, it creates even more opportunity for price gouging. We have seen with a new global war in Iran in 3 weeks, gas is up a dollar, but more price increases are going to go very, very quickly. What hasn't gotten enough talk about is that 50% of the world's urea goes through the Strait of Hormuz, which is a primary fertilizer that is used in a lot of our crops here in Minnesota and around the world. If farmers are paying more for their nitrate fertilizer, prices are going to go up. If prices go up, it allows for more price gouging. People might not even realize that they are paying more for their food than the next person in line behind them at the supermarket. So this is a great bill in general, but right now I think there's an urgency to make sure that Minnesota families are protected from the dollars in their pocket being less than they were when they put them in their pocket. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, any final thoughts, Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just say to Representative Smith's point, we know that companies are spending billions of dollars experimenting and innovating on this price revolution that is about charging every individual the maximum amount they will pay based on data that they have collected and consolidated. We know that. They're saying that on their earnings calls. So I think to the point of we have to do this now, it is only going to get worse for our privacy when the incentives is to collect more data. It's only going to get worse for our prices when they have built these models. This is happening now, but it is only growing. And so now is the time to take action. I think this should be a simple bipartisan vote because we all care about lowering prices. And if you care about lowering prices and protecting people's privacy, this is the yes vote for you.
Thank you. With that, the clerk, I will renew my motion that House File 3794 be referred to the General Register, and the clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Co-chair Cagle votes aye. Co-chair O'Driscoll?
No.
O'Driscoll nay. Co-vice chair Elkins?
Aye.
Elkins aye. Co-vice chair Perryman?
No.
Perryman nay. Representative Allen?
No.
Allen nay. Representative Buck is excused. Representative Cha?
Aye.
Cha, aye. Representative Davids?
No.
Davids, nay. Representative Dotseth?
No.
Dotseth, nay. Representative Falconer?
Aye.
Falconer, aye. Representative Finke?
Aye.
Finke, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Heintzman?
No.
Heintzman, nay. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Representative Katiza Watoon?
Aye.
Katiza Watoon, aye. Representative Kreisha?
No.
Kreisha, nay. Representative Reimer?
No.
Reimer, nay. Representative Smith?
Aye.
Smith, aye. Representative Van Binsbergen?
No.
Van Binsbergen, nay. Representative West?
No.
West, nay. Madam Chair, there are 9 ayes and 10 nays.
Being 9 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. Sorry about that one, too. All right, next up on the agenda is Representative Ryer. All right, I will move that House File 4472 before us with the intent to lay the bill over. Welcome to the committee, Representative Ryer. I understand that you have an A6 amendment.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
So I will move the A6 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape it would like. Would you please explain the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, the amendment, it's the A1, and the amendment adds an appropriation, which was currently black, or blank on the underlying bill. $18,000 for fiscal year 2026, $74,000 for fiscal 27, and then ongoing for $36,000 to be used by the Legislative Budget Office. It'll make sense as I explain the bill what they'll be doing, but essentially it's gathering the data and making it available for use and analysis.
Thank you. I'll correct the motion. I will move the A1 amendment to House File 4472. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Breyer, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll and members. It's really nice to be here. I enjoyed being on this committee, and I'm happy to be back. And I appreciate the chance to present House File 4472, which is the school health insurance survey bill. So, members, the healthcare system in the United States is broken. Spiraling costs, administrative complexity, and inequitable access to affordable care. For-profit businesses are exploiting the healthcare system to increase their own wealth. Meanwhile, employees in public school districts and charter schools across Minnesota are suffering the effects. Large districts like Anoka-Hennepin with 3,200 teachers faced a 22% premium increase in 1 year with family premiums of $1,000 a month, pushing teachers to the verge of a strike. Small districts like Kingsland Public Schools in Spring Valley with 44 teachers struggle too. A sixth grade teacher put it this way, either I get insurance or I get a paycheck. So the current approach just doesn't make sense. Each district pays its own brokers, manages its own contracts, and absorbs its own shocks from when an employee needs high-cost care. Each district, whether they have 3,200 teachers or 44. These unnecessary administrative costs take money from investing in students. The inefficiency is breathtaking. And this is a workforce issue. School employees change districts in pursuit of decent access to health care. Far too many dedicated people are forced out of education entirely due to this unsustainable system. These structural insurance issues are addressed in House File 2904, the Bipartisan Educator Group Insurance Program Bill, which establishes a single large pool for all Minnesota public and charter school employees. It'll look a lot like CGIP. It creates more financial stability for the districts while eliminating haves and have-nots. For school districts, this is a big change, and we need more discussion and analysis to implement it. The bill before you today, House File 4472, collects the data needed to move forward with the necessary analysis. It establishes a mandatory annual report that will provide district-level data, such as the number of employees and potential enrollees, broker fees, insurance carriers, plan names, actuarial values, benefit design, and plan financials, such as district and employee expenditures. And as I mentioned, the information will be collected and reported by the LBO. As you heard in the A1 amendment, it'll cost $18,000 in fiscal year 26, $74,027 due to the upfront loading of startup costs, and then $36,000 per year ongoing, as the amendment showed. Appreciate your consideration of the bill. I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Ryan. We have one testifier, Kristen Scott. If you could please make your way up or on Zoom. Oh, there she is. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Chair O'Driscoll, and ladies and gentlemen. My name is Kristen Scott, and I'm a proud AFSCME member and a paraprofessional in the Elk River School District. I'm here today to share about how the burden of health insurance premiums, on people like me. Working in public education is a calling. We surely aren't here to get rich. We're here because we love our kids. We're tasked with taking care of them every day, and we do this for far less than our equally educated counterparts in pretty much every other profession. The amount we pay in health care premiums and deductibles has continued to go up year after year much faster than our wages. The last renewal we had in my school district was 11% higher than the previous year. We had negotiated for a modest increase in the district's contributions to our premiums in our recent contract, and it was barely enough to cover it. It pretty much brought us back to where we started, and now we're looking at another increase. I sat this year on the insurance committee where we listened to a consulting company who was paid five times my yearly salary, explained to us how prices are going up for prescriptions and procedures, and that we were going to need at least a 10% increase just to cover expected costs, plus more to increase our reserve. We talked about how many people on our plan are high-cost claimants, because if we have too many of them, it could affect our renewal. God forbid one of our coworkers or our own family member has a heart attack, car accident, a cancer diagnosis, a premature baby. There's something wrong when someone who is going through one of the worst times in their life should feel bad for using the health insurance that they pay for. Yet these are the conversations that we have to have, and we're a decent-sized district. This hits smaller districts even harder. What we're doing now isn't sustainable. We need a more efficient, cost-effective health insurance system, and I believe the creation of an educator's group insurance plan is it. When we work together, we have increased bargaining power with the insurance companies and more stability for our families. I ask for your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Scott. Is there any members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Representative Kreshaw.
I can go to the end unless you have other questions. So,
Well, were you and Carly, or Representative Katiza Watoon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Breyer, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think, you know, I had a few teachers from my local district and then one of my constituents who works for another district come in and talk to me about this proposal last week. And some of the things that they were sharing about how much of an increase they are individually facing is really, I think, part of what we're seeing when people are not coming into the profession of being a public school teacher. And we know that it takes incredible people to educate our future leaders, our future workforce, just future incredible human beings. And it would seem to me that, you know, after the DFL passed a historic investment in our public schools back in the 2023-2024 legislative session, I spoke with my superintendent, and he said, we are so appreciative of this funding that you were able to provide for the schools. But because of the increase in benefits, there's already a lack that's happening because prices just keep going up. And it would seem to me that every district is probably facing similar pressures. If every district at this level is kind of trying to make the most affordable decision to ensure their workforce, wouldn't it make more sense for us to gather those folks together in a very large risk pool statewide and give the districts back that time from having to compare the costs and having to have all of those individual meetings? It just feels like this is bringing us to a potentially much more efficient way to make sure that the educators of the state of Minnesota are given what they need in order to sit in little fish tanks of germs surrounded by adorable learning children all day long. I mean, it's just a fact that they're at risk for a lot of the germs that kids have, and I think that this bill is really a good step in the right direction to make sure that we have all the information that we need to move forward in a much more efficient and effective manner utilizing taxpayer dollars. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Breyer, for bringing this bill. I would agree with Representative Katiza Watoon. This is a critical bill. Teachers are some of the most trusted and beloved members of our community wherever they are. But for some reason, that's not reflected in how we have compensated them for one of the most important jobs in our community. I know several teachers, and I've talked to many teachers, who do the job because they love it and because it gives them a benefit, a great benefit. But they have to work on the weekends, part-time job or drive, Lyft or deliver Grubhub, because they can't make a budget work on just the salary that they're given. And the quote-unquote raises they received from the grade bills that we passed in 2023 went almost immediately to rising premium costs. In my district, I can speak. One of the great things about this bill is we will know throughout the state what that looks like. I would imagine my district, one of the biggest in the state, while they're paying high premiums, they're probably not paying as high premiums as a teacher in Representative David's district, just half an hour south, just because it's a smaller pool. And probably both of those teachers are paying more than teachers statewide, because southeastern Minnesota, we have the highest premiums in the state. The bottom line is a larger pool should bring more affordable benefits to our teachers, and our teachers require and deserve the best possible coverage in health care and payment and ability to live their lives. So thank you, Representative Breyer.
Thank you. Reitinger, this bill is being laid over. And so we have Representative Elkins, Van Binsbergen, Kreisha, and then Chair O'Driscoll, if you want to close it up, and then we will move to the next bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to quickly make the observation that that this is a perfect example in microcosm of a more general problem that we have as the balkanization of our risk pools. And it extends all the way up to being essentially the root cause of why we end up having to put hundreds of millions of dollars into reinsurance every year as well, is that we end up with these small risk pools where there's an inordinate risk of, a few relatively expensive patients who are members of the pool. And this is, again, this is a much larger problem that we at some point need to address in a more general way.
Thank you. Representative Van Binsbergen. I got it right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, have some of the best teachers in Minnesota in my district. I know them. I go to church with them. They're in my community. I'm friends with them. And I care about my teachers as well. I look at this bill, Representative, and I really don't see where this is going to have an effect on what's important to them, and is lowering their premiums. And you know, I just like your comments of, you know, how does this really going to lower premiums? I see this as going to create more of a burden on our schools. You've got a small fiscal note to the state, but there's also a fiscal note to the schools that have to abide by another mandate that we are putting forward here in St. Paul.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. In fact, most of this information is already provided because they need to do it for the benefit process, for negotiations and so forth. This is not a unique set of information or particularly onerous. And I would argue that having a standardized approach is going to be of value to everybody rather than having the fragmented approach that we currently have. This is not a standalone in a sense. This gives us the information we need to have a health system for our teachers and educators that will serve all of them better.
Thank you. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, members, let me take you back to a time when unicorns ran through the fields and streets were filled with gold, and it was a wonderful time. And this was 14 years ago when I came in the legislature, and the first stab at this was what was called the Health Insurance Transparency Act, the HITA Act, which was PEEP. And the idea was, and it's a group insurance government unit, statute 471, but let's make all the school districts get a PEEP bid, public employees. Let's create this pool, right? Fantastic idea, everything you've heard here, except we have collective bargaining units, we have local school boards, and we have local schools that said, we don't want a standard process. Why? Because during our collective bargaining unit negotiations, we try to figure out how to fit the best benefits for the job and the culture that we have. So at that time, the DFL pushed forward, hey, every school district has to get a bid from PEEP. And then we ran into this buzzsaw of all these large suburban schools that said, you know what, we do our own self-insurance, so cut us out. And just to Representative Elkins' point, we started throwing the pool and fragmenting it all over to the point where some of these collective bargaining unions forced their school districts to go into PEEP only a year later to say, we want out because our premiums have gone way up and our benefits have gone down, because when you negotiated with the other private insurance companies, we got better benefits. The unicorns ran away, the streets of gold started to become bronze and eventually have become gravel. Members, I get it. I was a teacher as well. My goodness, let's quit telling the teachers they are incapable of figuring out how to deal with their own economics.
You know, if we want to go out, I'll go out and do two other jobs. I'll figure, there's things I like to do. I like to do aviation teaching. When I was in schools, I liked to work as a carpenter. I worked in industrial stuff. And in the summers, I was building houses with Habitat for Humanity and other things. Teachers can figure this out. Health insurance is difficult across the place. But when you do this and you put more mandates on the schools, and if we want to go to a standardized one school board for the whole state, then let's get rid of the local control. Let's, everything's going to collapse down. This market will fall on the schools. You will do more harm to your schools and those collective bargaining by forcing them into this. I appreciate the comments. I actually don't. It's sarcasm. But this whole historic investment is so historic that the governor is cutting another $50 million of special ed on top of the $300 million cuts he's proposed. So you keep throwing great things at the schools, and right now the oxygen is running out, the unicorns have gone, and nobody's happy.
Thank you, Representative Kreshaw.
I'm not really done, but okay. But you know what? I think I will be done.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
No, I'm done.
All right. Chair O'Driscoll?
That's aggressive. Pass, ma'am.
Thank you. Chair. All right. With that, any final thoughts, Representative Ryer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, everyone. I do appreciate hearing all of their perspectives, and I'm not being sarcastic, because I know those are what people are thinking, and so I want to know those things. But this is not PEEP. I was also in the land of unicorns. I was at Blue Cross during PEEP, and so I know the differences. This is not PEEP, and I just must say on behalf of teachers, it hurts my heart to see someone say, let them go out and get two jobs. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And with that, I will lay over House File 4472. All right. Next up, Representative Davids. Representative Davids, would you like to move your bill before us?
Yes, I will move House File 4410. And I had a request from Public Safety. They need to see it. So the motion be to go to Public Safety. House File 4410 is a bill that prohibits online sweepstakes games being operated, conducted, and promoted in Minnesota. If I could get House Research, Ms. Hagler, maybe to give a brief description.
Ms. Hagler?
excuse me, Madam Chair and members, House File 4410 would prohibit the a person in Minnesota or a company to operate or conduct or promote online sweepstakes in Minnesota. And the prohibition extends to entities that assist in that operation, such as platform providers, payment processors, and financial institutions. And then the bill also imposes the same penalty violations for violation of existing prize law. And lastly, gives the Commissioner of Public Safety and the Attorney General authority to deny anyone from commencing the operations or continuing if they are already doing so.
Thank you very much. Representative Davids?
Well, thank you very much, and thank you, Ms. Hagler. If we could get testifiers that support the bill first.
And testifiers?
Okay.
Mr. Plate?
Nobody supports my bill.
Mr. Play. Oh, okay. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. I'm Andy Plato, Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association. On behalf of our nine tribal nation members, please accept our strong support for House File 4410, Chair David's bill to ban sweepstakes casinos. Sweeps casinos are unregulated and illegal gaming platforms that advertise here every day. I just saw one in the morning edition of the Pioneer Press. Internet gambling is illegal under Minnesota law, and sweepstakes products, which masquerade as free to play, are taking deposits and reporting billions in earnings annually. These casinos, such as Chumba, Stake, and Wow Vegas, offer every game imagined and hide behind a deceptive dual currency model designed to skirt existing gaming laws. 25 plus states have seen through this deception and responded with bans, restrictions, or have legislation pending. House File 4410 follows that lead to assert that internet gambling is illegal in Minnesota until the legislature says otherwise. We also appreciate that this bill does not interfere with currently legal promotional tools. Any normal sweepstakes or social game that doesn't use dual currency and casino games should continue to be allowed, and House File 4410 recognizes that. Again, thanks to authors, chairs, and committee, this bill protects Minnesota consumers and rightfully clarifies that these real money casinos are illegal. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Now is your opportunity.
Okay, so I've got a few folks that are opposing, I think.
All right. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Patrick Fechtmeyer.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Patrick Fechtmeyer. I'm the founder and CEO of Arrabee Interactive, the company behind Modo, the largest U.S.-based social gaming platform, and the owner of Publishers Clearing House, a brand with more than 70 years of lawful sweepstakes experience. Before I begin, I would like to take a moment to thank Representative Davids. While we disagree with the language in his bill, he was very willing to meet with my team to discuss our concerns. I hope we are able to continue those conversations to eventually find an agreement that works for everybody. To start, I would like to address one mischaracterization of social gaming off the bat. We are not offshore. I sit before you as a Minnesotan. I grew up here. I went to high school in Minneapolis, and I attended the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management. This state shaped how I think about business, responsibility, and community. It's why I care deeply about getting this right. Today, ARB employs over 200 people in the United States in high-quality technology jobs. We serve millions of players who are looking for safe, transparent, and entertaining digital experiences. Participation in our sweepstakes is always free, with clear alternative methods of entry, and compliance with state law is central to how we operate. I grew up in the first generation native to the internet, and one lesson has become very clear. When you try to ban digital behavior that people want, it doesn't disappear. It moves, and usually moves to places that are harder to regulate and less safe for consumers. If this bill is passed, it will not eliminate this activity. Instead, it will push Minnesotans to the 1,100 offshore operators who hide behind shell companies and don't comply with consumer protections or sweepstakes laws. While companies like ours, companies that have roots in Minnesota, invest heavily in age verification, geolocation, compliance and consumer protections, and believe in proactive engagements with stakeholders, will exit, leaving consumers completely unprotected and vulnerable. At the same time, it closes the door on the opportunity to create a modern, enforceable framework that could both protect consumers and generate significant tax revenue. In the end, consumers are unprotected and the state left without tax revenue. The only people who will win is offshore operators. Minnesota has a real opportunity here, not just to react, but to lead. We can modernize sweepstakes laws in a way that creates clarity, strengthens consumer protections, establishes enforceable standards, and ensures the state benefits from economic activity that is already happening. We only became aware of this bill recently, and it has serious flaws which could ban many forms of digital sweepstakes. Given the complexity of this issue and the long-term implications, I respectfully ask the committee to defer this bill until next session. That would give all the stakeholders the time to come together and work towards a thoughtful, balanced solution that reflects where technology is today and where it is heading over the next 20 years. We all want what's best for Minnesota. My hope is that we take the time to make sure we get it right. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Lexi Morgan. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Lexi Morgan, and I am appearing on behalf of the Social Gaming Leadership Alliance. Respectfully, we rise in opposition to HF 4410. Our association includes the largest, most established, and most innovative companies in the Social Plus industry, some of which have been operating in Minnesota for well over a decade. Our members share a commitment to ensuring that the more than 220,000 Minnesota adults who play these games are protected. SGLA members operate under strict internal advertising standards, along with robust consumer protections, including 21-plus age requirements, identity verification, geolocation, and responsible social gameplay tools. If this bill is passed, it will push our association's longstanding responsible social plus companies out of the state, only to be replaced by illegal operators with exploitative business practices. I want to address some of the statements made by the supporters of this bill. There is a lot of confusion about this topic and, with respect, an incomplete understanding of our industry. Social plus games are regulated. SGLA members comply with Minnesota sweepstakes laws and every facet of Minnesota consumer protection law. Additionally, our industry is regulated at the federal level by the FTC, FCC, U.S. Postal Service, and DOJ Consumer Protection Division. We do believe that Minnesota sweepstakes laws should be updated for the digital age to provide further guardrails. We want to engage with the state in a regulatory and taxing framework, which could generate significant revenue for the state. Social plus games do not compete against casinos and charitable organizations. The way people participate in these games is entirely different than real money gambling. No money or consideration is ever required for a player to enter the sweepstakes. More than half of the participants never spend any money to play these games. This bill was introduced last Monday, and we appreciate Representative David's accessibility and his willingness to engage with us. Unfortunately, there's not enough time for a nuanced discussion to address all of these misconceptions, which is why we are asking this committee to give this issue further opportunity for study before enacting a counterproductive ban. We want to work with members of this committee in the coming months to create legislation that will protect Minnesota consumers and generate substantial tax revenue. We hope to continue this productive conversation, and I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you very much. Is there any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. Any questions to the bill author? Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quickly, so with prohibiting anything, I'm generally opposed because it pushes people into the illegal markets. We see that with cannabis. We see that with sports betting. We see that with a lot of things, and I believe this will do the same. But my question is on the anybody who is promoting these operations is violating the statute. And it says knowingly. So how is that going to be determined with, you know, the Commissioner of Public Safety or the Attorney General say an online platform is advertising for them, but that ad was placed by a third-party operation, you know, like Google AdSense. They didn't know that it was going to be promoting, but how are you going to prevent them from allowing that under this bill since it says they cannot promote it?
Chair Davids.
Yes. Well, that's one very good reason why on line 2.5, this does need to go to the Commissioner of Public Safety, number one. Number two, one could probably argue, although I haven't heard from any judiciary-type folks, the Attorney General, so I think some of those questions need to be answered in public safety.
And the motion is to move this bill to public safety. Yeah. Any other member discussion? All right. Seeing none. Chair Davids, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, and I thank you very much, Chair Hagel, for the hearing. We've got some work to do on this. My bill is somewhat aggressive, like it would put a lot of these folks out of business. What I want to be able to determine is who's operating legally, who is not operating legally, and let's go after the ones that are not operating legally. But I think on a lot of the sweepstakes stuff, we've been doing it for years. I mean, you go to McDonald's, and I always want a free small fry, and it's delicious. So that being said, members, I'd appreciate your support to get this word to public safety so we can continue working on this.
Thank you. And with that, we will move the bill to public safety. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. House File 4410 is on its way to public safety. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. Representative Hansen. And we are running a little tight on time, so if everybody could please shorten their remarks and make it quick, I would very much appreciate it. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I have a DE amendment as well, please.
So, Okay, so House File 4203 will be moved before us with the intent to move it to Ways and Means. Representative Hansen, would you please explain your DE amendment?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. This is an agency bill that was split up into a couple different bills. So what I'll do is I'll go over this vehicle bill, 4203, and then I'll also go over each of the other bills that we're amending in. And then I'll just chat about some of the other things that I think are helpful for you. So first of all, House File 4203 is going to be eliminating some of the duplicative reports to ensure that the agency can report efficiently. The bill maintains the requirement for OCM to report on the CAN grants. And there is a letter in your packets from the Cannabis Research Center to check out. I think their work is really important to highlight, and I would just like you to take a second to see the cool reports that they do about the intersection of legalization and public health. They produce these regularly, and the OCM website also offers a dashboard that's truly very helpful. So if you're curious about reports, definitely check those out. House File 4199 is also included in the DE. It repeals the temporary regulations that were used to transition hemp regulations into alignment with cannabis regulations. And this transition has already happened, so we no longer need that in statute. 4199 also aligns the term license holder and licensee. Pretty simple cleanup there. It also clarifies that the Department of Labor that's referenced in the law is meaning the Minnesota Department of Labor, and so it replaces that reference and replaces the use of NLRB violations with the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry violations. The 4199 also allows businesses to sell equipment and other non-cannabis products to each other, like shelving or other retail, cultivation, or manufacturing equipment, for example. It also requires a background check and LPA be signed within 6 months of being deemed a qualified applicant. This clears the licensing pipeline a little bit of people who applied for a license but have not submitted a background check or an LPA within a reasonable amount of time. Currently, the language eliminates the reference and uses the term hemp-derived consumer products, which are high-dose hemp products, which are basically just cannabis products. So we're trying to kind of eliminate this gray area in the law. I'm not going to go into that too much because this was an agreement that we discussed with Representative West and have accepted, and so that part will probably likely come out, so I won't go into too much detail about that piece of it. The next bill that's in the DE is House File 4201. This bill provides a bridge for businesses that are currently holding a hemp license to bridge into cannabis if they want to. Presently, if a restaurant owner, for example, is selling THC drinks at their bar, and they would have to stop doing so if they wanted to get into cannabis and hold a license. Similarly, a brewery that's struggling because of all of the federal upends, they would have to be required to close shop or stop brewing or stop selling those drinks before starting the process of getting into cannabis. So this will provide a bridge for those experienced small business owners to get into cannabis if they so choose to do so. This also then requires the 21 plus and stop warnings be included on hemp products. The non-intoxicating products do not need to have the THC warning, but have to have the poison control number. And then it also allows that non-intoxicating products like the full spectrum topical creams that a lot of folks use for arthritis or joint pain must include a THC warning because there are trace amounts of THC in that when they're using a full spectrum product. And it should be accurately labeled as such. 4201 also allows hemp products to replace many of the labeling requirements with a QR code to save space on their packages. This is something we used to do and was something that the industry had asked us to bring back up, and so we're willing to do that. The batch number will need to continue to be printed on the package itself and not embedded in the QR code for the sake of recalls. Imagine being a liquor store and having to scan a bunch of QR codes to see what was recalled, kind of a nightmare. So that will remain just like you see on your cans of soda or LaCroix or whatever you might have. We are also going to be expanding to have that QR code available on cannabis packages, again, as an agreement with Representative West, to make sure that we could extend that courtesy to them too. The next bill is House File 4398. Presently, a business would have to get a new license if they change their business structure from like an Inc. to an LLC. And that's kind of a pain. And so this is going to change that so that they can just update their structure, their W-9 documents with us instead. And this is something that the industry has asked us to work on because it's just kind of a headache for folks. This bill also confirms that if somebody had a license at one point and it had been revoked, that and then they apply again, that the office can consider that previous revocation as justification for initial denial rather than sending them through the whole process of wasting their time, resources, and going through a deeper part of the application process. 4398 also establishes that the office can determine the length of a disqualification for somebody who lies on their application regarding their true party of parties of interest that are involved in their business, or in, if they're the true party of interest of the businesses they're also involved in. It could go both ways. It also moves the reference to civil penalties from the criminal disqualification heading under the civil penalties section, where this language really belongs in the statute. The statute currently lists that retail, cultivation, and manufacturing as their own sections of law in Chapter 342 right now. And so what we've also done is moved into each of those sections the micro and meso vertically integrated things. So if you're a micro business, we want you to be able to just look at the micro statute and understand what you're able to do, trying to be a little bit more transparent with the law there under one statute for each type of business. This bill also has language to bring this industry in alignment with, this is kind of a fun fact if you've been in the legislature for a while and didn't know this, but there's a 1993 environment law that requires anything that's a rechargeable device have removable batteries. And that's, like, in the industry, we have a lot of disposable vapes. And so that actually technically makes these not in compliance with that. I actually won't go into that too much, though, because, again, this was a deal that we agreed to with Representative West to remove that feature. For the sake of time and nonpartisan staff, we just brought the bills in its entirety, so these conversations are going to continue. So I'll keep highlighting those things as we get to them. And then lastly, this 4398 also authorizes OCM to levy civil penalties on non-licensed businesses that are selling products that they would normally need a license for. So if you have a gas station or somewhere that's selling pre-rolls out of the back, this would allow the office to level a civil penalty for selling without a license. House File 4412 is in here. This is a bill from Representative Allen that would allow a medical cannabis consultant or pharmacist to be contracted or employed by a retailer with a medical cannabis endorsement versus being restricted to a W-2 employee, as it says in the current statute. So we're happy to accept that. We may have to work on some of the language for some union things, but again, we wanted to negotiate in good faith and make sure we included that in this as well. Next bill is House File 4397, and this is one of the larger issues and topics that have come up. It is kind of a complicated subject, so I'll talk fast through it, but feel free to catch me offline or talk to Representative West if you have any questions about this. But House File 4397 is a streamlining bill. When we originally passed legalization, we have the medical combination companies. They're held to a ratio of what their canopy can be sold for. And so this bill ensures that medical patients can access these high-need medical products that diversifies their product and store options throughout the state by expanding that medical market to more folks. The current med combo licenses and the statutory structures, they were always designed to be a bridge toward a more appropriate model once the market was really woken up. And it's critical that we move forward that way to ensure that there's broad access and like a diversity of medical products that are on the market, particularly for people with rare conditions and children with conditions. At this time, nearly all the medical patients can get their products at two companies and who each have eight locations around the state. And this is going to incentivize businesses with a micro, meso, retailer, manufacturing, or cultivation license to grow, make, sell high-need medical products in high-need medical areas of the state where there's that limited access. So you'll see that this bill renames the med combo license to macro, proposes a petition and transition process to current license holders, and there's a lot of other things in here. But as we go through this particular provision, you can hear, it sounds pretty complicated. We're going to continue the conversations into conference on this. We're out of line with where the Senate is at with this right now anyway. And so many of the specific numbers, details, and things in this bill may change. And so I want to be very transparent about that. Last two bills are not in our jurisdiction. I won't be amending them in here, but just telling you so you know about them. There's a bill in Judiciary, House File 4200, and a bill in Local GovOps that addresses some of the local control concerns we've heard in House File 4202. I'll bring those in at Ways and Means, and we'll do that after I present them in those two committees. So That's a lot of information to go as fast as I could, Chair.
Thank you.
That.
I very much appreciate it.
I'm trying to take your lead on that. I will say that there's some ongoing negotiations that are happening in terms of some other language. We had a number of agreements that we struck with Representative West that, unfortunately, nonpartisan staff was on a real time crunch, and so we weren't able to get everything drafted in alignment with everything we were looking for here. But we have offered and put in writing that we are willing to accept a number of those things. But again, the streamlining conversation is one that broadly across all stakeholders and all of our partners have agreed that we're going to take that back to conference because it will be a longer conversation. And we do intend to make sure that we have broad stakeholder agreement for all of that before we move on any of that too. So as always, cannabis bills can get complicated, especially in the final moments. I hope that answers your questions, but I will turn it back to you, Chair.
Thank you. And so we are moving the DE amendment right now. So all those in favor of the DE1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails. All right, we have some testifiers. We have Juan Aguara and Gina Gomez. Anybody? No? Don't see him? Okay, Glenn McElfresh. And he is on
the line. Hi, Chair.
Good morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Cagle, Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Hansen and committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak today in support of House File 4203. I'd also like to thank Director Tauble and the OCM staff for their tireless work ethic as they field a variety of different requests from a multitude of stakeholders. And thank you again to Representative Hansen and Representative West for their tireless advocacy on behalf of the industry. My name is Glenn McElfresh, and I'm here today as the co-founder of Plyft, a lower-potency hemp beverage company. I also own Perfectly Dosed, the leading cannabinoid emulsion company, and sit on the board of the Hemp Beverage Alliance. Almost 1 year ago today, I sat in front of this committee and talked about how whenever a new hemp beverage brand reaches out to me for advice on where to launch their product, my answer is always Minnesota. Well, I'm proud to report that my answer still hasn't changed over the past year. Minnesota is still the best market to launch a hemp beverage. The OCM has done yeoman's work to draft and implement regulations with unprecedented transparency. However, despite the department's best attempts to provide a pro-business regulatory environment while protecting consumers and faithfully implementing the law as drafted by this body, the labeling requirement of at 342.63 subdivision 7, which mandates the name, address, and license number of the hemp cultivator, hemp processor, and manufacturer has caused consternation amongst industry participants. In fact, over the past 12 months, both new and well-established brands are choosing to forego launching their products in Minnesota because these labeling requirements do not account for the hoops nearly every hemp beverage company must manage on a regular basis. I have not met a single business owner who disagrees with the spirit of these labeling requirements. However, requiring these batch-level production disclosures can force businesses into difficult decisions that conflict with ingredient and materials lead times in this industry. For example, nearly every lower potency hemp edible business has had to shift co-packers at the last minute, and many brands have had to purchase emulsion at the last minute, which would lead to changes and conflicts on the hemp cultivator, processor, and manufacturer information displayed on the label. However, in both of these scenarios, the cans or labels would have already been printed with the original information, and a brand must choose between waiting for new cans or labels, stickering after production, or foregoing Minnesota sales entirely. Thankfully, all brands sold in Minnesota already handle batch-level testing information by including that information behind a QR code and adding batch-level production information slots neatly into existing operational workflows for LPHEs. House File 4203 and the bills, which I hope become a part of the final omnibus, contain simple fixes which allow businesses more flexibility to manage supply chain surprises and scaling while still providing truth in labeling and transparency to the consumer. Nearly every brand I've ever met is proud of where they source their THC, whether it's from my company Perfectly Dosed, Superior Molecular in White Bear Lake, or Northern Diversified in Burnsville. This change will keep in line with the spirit of the law, which promotes consumer safety and transparency while evolving with the national hemp beverage regulatory landscape. Thank you once again for the opportunity to testify today. I hope I got through it quickly, and I'm happy to stay in line to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Is there any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. Representative West.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, so we, during our talks on this bill, we discussed basically everything here. And just to clarify, a document that was handed out, it does say House DFL at the top. This is a document that I printed here, so it's not from the House DFL. The only difference from what the House DFL wrote is under House, the bullets of House File 4397 at the bottom of the page, the three words opt-out option. So in our discussions, that was a topic of discussion because a lot of businesses, the two Med Combo businesses have made tremendous investments in this state, and the rules keep changing, which is something we need to be aware of when we change the rules yet again. Discussing this opt-out option started really early in our conversations, and when we had a tentative agreement, it was the understanding of myself that the document that I just distributed was the agreement. It seems like there was crossed wires, as we've discussed while this hearing has been going on. My hope is that you can commit to, in ways and means, getting the bill in the shape of which this document reflects so that we can move forward in this process. I understand there is some DE crafting, but if we move forward in this manner, I am confident that that will be able to happen. So that is what I would ask. You mentioned that the bill was going to go to conference anyways, so, and this would be a hot topic of discussion. This reflects our understanding of the agreement that we would be sending out, and in the interest of keeping things moving, we're fine with the DE amendment as is, just for the sake of movement, but in ways and means would like it to directly reflect what is in this document. And then we can have those discussions in the conference committee, as you already stated.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative West. If anybody's ever negotiated with me, I've always told you I'm a very transparent negotiator. That's why you got a written agreement from me. This was offer number 6 that was sent. The goalpost moved several times this weekend, and we were very accommodating, working all the way through the weekend to work on this, and we decided to meet you where you were at. I had agreed that we would accept everything on this document, and you would just have to bring an amendment to do so. As we talked about, the nonpartisan staff was not able to get as many amendments drafted in time, given that we did not have an agreement until Monday afternoon. And so we have to respect our staff. I think that's a really important part of our job here. And in doing so, I was able to find a way to at least combine all of the agency bills and then pull in Representative Allen's bill really as a matter of being transparent with the public and making sure we could do that. So, you know, these documents are sent over because they are us telling you what we, you know, what, where we expect those things to be done. You have a list of all of the provisions that you'd like to add in. So I would anticipate at Ways and Means that that would be the amendment that you bring forward and that we can discuss at that time. I think that's what we've all agreed on. And I'm not quite sure if there's disagreement there or why this is coming up the way it is right now, but I hope that I've answered your question.
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was a commitment to assist in having our agreement reflect this document, which I did not hear that. So,
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair. Chair West, or Representative West, sorry, we're on Children and Families where you are, Chair West over there. We offered this document, we typed it, we sent it to you, so I don't know if you needed my signature on it or what additional information we could do to offer you that or what kind of other clarification you're looking for. I will say that the provision that this is highly controversial. By nature, the way that we've crafted the industry has never been to carve it around any one specific business. That's been a principle that we've carried through the House and the Senate. It will be a lift there. I'm not going to tell you that it's a straight sale. I think also the option that you're looking for on that is that, the particular company you're asking for that for has mentioned that they don't want that to hold things up, and so they are willing to sit at the table and come to an agreement. So I think between now and Ways and Means, there's going to be a lot of conversation. There always is on cannabis bills. I know that's not news to you. You've been in this ride with me the whole time. And so I think that's what you could probably expect to see. As I mentioned in my other comments, the streamlining proposal in general is a very complicated thing. We want to make sure everybody's on board with that nobody feels railroaded by that. Again, I'm a transparent negotiator, and I want to make sure everyone's on the same page. And that would include, making sure all the stakeholders are ready to move on that. I think I'll leave it at that. I had one more thing which has left my mind that I was going to also add, but I just forgot it.
Thank you. Any other questions, concerns? Otherwise, we will move to a vote.
Madam Chair, just one quick question. So Representative Hansen, is the answer yes or no to supporting what Representative West is asking as we're considering a vote here?
Representative Hansen. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Like I said, we sent this, so I mean, it's an implied, like, if he wants to bring this amendment forward, I mean, he's absolutely welcome to do any of that, and we've said that we would to be amended at Ways and Means. We'll have to make sure we have the votes for it. We'll have to talk to all the members of Ways and Means. I can't speak for all the members there, so I can't guarantee that it will be amended on by any means, nor that the stakeholders will all be on the same page. It's my understanding that this has not been vetted with all the stakeholders, so I don't have a crystal ball, and I'm not going to pretend like I do, but it is something that, you know, he's wanted to bring up, and I think having the conversation about it is fair, and I agreed to offer to have it amended at Ways and Means. That's why I put it on the document.
Madam Chair, one question. Representative West, what would you like to do with us this morning?
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand you can't speak for the rest of the committee. I would never speak for my esteemed colleagues either, but you can speak for yourself, and that is, I am interested in that.
Okay, thank you. I think what she's saying is that she's going to continue to work with you on it. And that she will go ahead, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I guess I'm not trying to like beat around the bush here. Like, if somebody sends you an offer letter and it says an offer from DFL, like, do you want me to sign it for you? Like, do you want me to say yes, you can bring it as an amendment? You have an election certificate, Representative West, and you're welcome to bring any amendment you want. And I think that we had agreed that you would get that amendment drafted for Ways and Means that includes your number of other provisions. I'm happy to go over those other provisions in front of the committee if you want to go over those. I'm happy to talk about those. I think the chair's pushing for time right now, though, so yeah. I wasn't going
to
do that.
So we're going to move to a vote right now. Representative West, short.
Literally. Yeah.
Go.
You mentioned signing this document. I would consider if you would sign this document as what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I mean, it came from our staff, so I mean, it's all implied, staff. But yes.
All right. If you have it, let's.
Thank you. All right. We are going to move to a vote now. So I will move. Where are you on my thing?
You know.
House file 44203 as amended. Any final thoughts, Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to like follow up on this. That like I don't want to say yes, it's going to end up on it for two reasons. Number one, I'm not on Ways and Means, right? We would have to talk to all the members and make sure they do that. I'm not going to falsely like promise something I can't deliver on again. And number two, the person that you're asking for this carve out for, you know, we've had discussions with them. This is not something necessarily that they're guaranteed they're looking for. So I don't want to speak for them either. So I want to be really clear with this committee and make, like, and I'm happy to show anybody the messages if they'd like to see them. But I think it's fair to say that we have work to continue doing on streamlining. That's been the conversation since this conversation started. I did offer Representative West to carry the streamlining bill and to transfer authorship so that he could be fully in control of that policy and trying to be, you know, generous on that and respectful because he started that work last year.
Okay.
And that was not something he was interested in. So I'm not saying no. I don't have the power to vote for those members. And I also, you know, I don't want to speak for the person, the company that you are asking to do this particular option for, given the messages I've received in the last little bit here. I don't want to misrepresent their position.
Sorry, we're running short on time.
Yep,
so I'm going to move, renew Representative Hansen's motion that House File 4203 as amended be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Motion.
Madam Chair, division.
Division. All those in favor, raise your hand. All those opposed? All right. 9 votes in favor, 10 opposed. The motion does not prevail. All right.
Chair,
we have 5 extra minutes, and we have one agency bill to do quickly.
Really quick comment. I just want to say I'm sorry to all the stakeholders after we had been given the commitment that we would continue those conversations. I'm really sorry. We went back and forth all weekend with you, and thank you for having the conversation, and we will see you next year. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I agree.
Members, for our last item of business today, we have 4188 before us with the intent to move the bill to the general register. Members, the bill before us is the intended commerce policy omnibus vehicle bill. All of the bills included in this are agency bills. Madam Chair, would you like
to move? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 4188 to the General Register. This is a combination of a bunch of the agency bills with crypto kiosks, residential mortgage loan servicing, student loan borrowers, insurance lead generators, Minnesota transaction, real estate appraisal. Look at your bill brief. I will hand it over to Mr. Smith
Madam Chair, do you have
to move the DE amendment.
You have a DE amendment. Yes. Would you like to move the DE3?
I will move the DE to the 4188, and then I will let Mr. Smith talk to the DE.
Okay. Can we vote to adopt the DE? Members, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. You may proceed, Mr. Smith.
Chair Elkins, Chair O'Driscoll, my name is Sam Smith. I'm here to testify to the amended House File 4188 on behalf of the Department of Commerce. Given the tight timelines, I'm going to move very quickly, so apologies there, and will primarily speak to any new language that's not been in previous versions of this bill. In the first article on consumer protections, there is an amendment that we developed in consultation with MFC and CIFMA, MFC regarding lead generator section. This is clarifying language we very much appreciate. There is also language governing the copper wire statute that is responsive to a very recent court case. This language was shared with the City of St. Paul, scrap metal dealers, Liuna sheet metal workers, and we believe there is consensus here. I've not heard any opposition. Going into the bill itself, there is some items on gold bullion, harmonizing some licensing standards, the lead generator portion I've already mentioned, some appraisal reporting requirements, student loan borrowing rights, and updated language that reflects a compromise package around a virtual kiosk ban. In Article 2, there is our technical and corrections bill. This features an amendment governing pennies that was developed in consultation with MBA. The Mint is no longer producing pennies, and so we are repealing a section of statute that requires payment in exact change. There is existing federal guidance on how to navigate this challenge, and so the repealer is all that we need to accomplish at this time. Beyond that, there are some changes, technical in nature and around compliance with some NAIC date standards, some banking tweaks, as well as modernizing our American Society of Testing Materials manual governing Minnesota fuel standards. In Article 3, Article 3 was heard in this committee previously, but features an amendment developed in consultation with MFC and CIFMA to ensure that we are complying with federal standards. Very much appreciate working with them, and I'm glad that that's in the bill. And finally, in Article 4, this represents a pared-down version of our unclaimed property statutes. Very much would like to thank the Minnesota Bankers Association, BankIn, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, MFC and CIFMA, and everyone else that worked with us towards reaching a compromise on unclaimed property. We will work on a full-blown revision over the summer, but for now there are a few key items we wanted to bring in. This includes incorporating virtual currency into our unclaimed property regime, adding unclaimed burial insurance benefits to our unclaimed property regime, and exempting 529 plans from state statute. Happy to answer any additional questions on the bill, and apologies for having to move so quickly.
Okay. We have one additional testifier listed. Christopher Edwards, are you present? Mr.
Yes,
Edwards is not present, so we can proceed to questions.
He's online.
Oh, he's online. I'm sorry.
Oh.
There we go. Okay, you may proceed.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Chris Edwards, and I'm Assistant General Counsel at Bitcoin Depot. We have the largest number of virtual currency kiosks in the United States. We share the concerns regarding virtual currency fraud, but we oppose Section 2 of House File 4188, which would ban our business in Minnesota. Instead of banning our machines, we ask this committee to consider consumer protections that would stop fraud. We have a list of provisions that we've worked on with other crypto kiosk operators in Minnesota that include transaction limits, ID verifications, transaction holds, and these provisions would go a tremendous way in fighting fraud. We support all of these provisions, And these controls would really address the concerns behind crypto fraud while keeping a regulated pathway open for our legitimate customer base. That legitimate customer base includes cash workers without bank accounts and those who want to hold their crypto directly using self-custody, which we offer. My final note is if our proposed compliance controls are implemented, then kiosks can become a tool that is used for catching and stopping fraud. If we remove kiosks in their entirety, then fraudsters move to
Mr. Edwards, can you wrap it up? We are on a severe time deadline here.
Absolutely. We want to work to stop scams is the bottom line. We believe we can do that without taking away kiosks in the state.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Members, discussion, questions? Seeing none, I think author of the bill, Chair, would you like a final thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I would just like to move 4188 as amended to the General Register.
Okay. With that, we move to a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We are done. So, good work.